You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Frankie Barnhill, filling in for Gemma Gaudette. Well, we've made it to another Friday, which means it's time for the Reporter Roundtable. There's so much to cover with our panel, so let's get into it. Our guest today, Kevin Richards, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, Kelsey Mosley Morris with the Idaho Capital Sun, Rachel Spacek with the Idaho Statesman, and Boise-based freelance reporter Heath Druzin. Hello, everyone.
Happy hey, Frankie.
Hello.
Happy Friday. Well, before we bring things home to Idaho, I want to start with some big international news of the week, of course. That's the United States has ended its military mission in Afghanistan earlier this week after the Taliban took over. This is, you know, the 20-year war that spanned four different administrations, a bipartisan war. The embassy in Kabul is closed. President Biden has defended the mission to get Americans and Afghan allies out of the country before the August 31st deadline. And the Biden administration says it's airlifted 124,000 people from Kabul in the past few weeks. Among them, well, we're going to hear about one of those people right now with Heath Druzin. Heath, we've had you on the show, I think it was a couple weeks ago, talking about a friend of yours, a colleague who you met when you were a reporter in Afghanistan with the outlet Stars and Stripes. Tell us about your friend and what's going on now.
Yeah, well, I fortunately have got much better news than the last time I was on. So this is my friend and colleague, Zubair Babakarhel, and I worked right alongside him for years in Afghanistan. He's a very accomplished journalist in his own right, and he worked with me in Afghanistan as a fellow journalist and a translator, and really the person who kept me safe in a very dangerous environment. So yes. And I mean, as you would imagine, working side by side for that long, we became very close. He's really a dear friend of mine. And he, like many others, just had a terrible time getting out, even though he is in the process known as the special immigrant visa process, meaning that he was well on his way to having a visa that basically said he could go to the United States because he was under threat from the Taliban. But he, his wife, and his three kids, it was just a 10-day nightmare to get out of the country. But we're so thankful that he did make it.
And how close to the deadline was it to get him out?
It was really close. So there were a few things at play. He got out about 24 hours before that awful bombing went off that killed almost 200 Afghan civilians and 13 U.S. troops. And, you know, that went off right by where he was going through the gate. Fortunately, you know, he got out a day before that. And then I have to go back and check, but it was 2 or 3 days later that all flights ceased. So, you know, it wasn't guaranteed that he'd get out. And I know it's hard to look at this grim news every day, but I would urge people not to turn away from Afghanistan because there's so many more people like Zubair who didn't make it out. You know, it was hard enough to get out for him, and he had kind of a team of people behind the scenes who had worked with him and who were just kind of working on his behalf to get him out. And even then, we barely were able to, and frankly, it was his own Herculean efforts through some really, really tough circumstances to actually make it through that gate onto the airfield and ultimately in the U.S. And he is in the U.S. now, so we're very relieved.
And yeah, I can only imagine. I'm sure it was an emotional roller coaster for you and your colleagues trying to work to get him out. And I know that you were helping to raise money for him to help make this possible. And full disclosure, I did make a very small donation to that fund. I should say that. Very glad to hear that they are now safe in the U.S. But what's next? I mean, where will they go as the U.S. begins to try and resettle these people who are now refugees, who are our allies in Afghanistan? Is Boise an option?
Yeah, so just a quick, huge thanks to the amazing outpouring of support that we got, including you. Thank you, Frankie. People are really stepping up, and we appreciate that. Because people like Zubair are coming here, basically we're told, don't bring more than a backpack on the plane. There's not room. So it's hard for us in the U.S., I think, to imagine a lot of times what that's like. But they basically left everything in Afghanistan, and they're coming here and starting with almost nothing. the logistics of it is usually they will go to a U.S. base, in Zubair's case, in Qatar in the Middle East first. There's some processing there, and then on to Ramstein, which is a base in Germany, for more processing. Now he did just make it to the U.S., and most people are being routed through the D.C. area. And then a couple of things can happen. They can be taken in by a refugee organization, or they can actually do some more processing at another U.S. military base. In this case, he's going to Fort McCoy in Wisconsin. It's a long process. Obviously, these guys are exhausted after what they went through. But after all of this sort of military processing, they will be resettled, and they have a lot of say in where they go. But it just depends on a lot of things. Boise certainly is an area that's welcomed refugees, and I would be surprised if we didn't get some of these folks coming over. There's already a small Afghan refugee community here, and there's some things in Boise that I think are attractive to refugee agencies. Certainly, like entry level jobs, and this is changing, but historically affordability.
Right.
So I don't know for sure, but I think it's likely that we will be seeing some of these folks.
And Kelsey, if I could bring you in, I understand that you've done a little bit of reporting on an Afghan family already here in Idaho, have been trying to get their family members back in Afghanistan out. Can you share a little bit about that story?
Yeah, I spoke to a woman who came here in 2003 as a refugee when she was about 14, after the first Taliban takeover from the 90s. And she works here as a processing engineer now for a chemical company. But she still has extended family over in Afghanistan, about 20 family members. Her parents are here, but her aunts and uncles and cousins are over there, including a 21-year-old journalist who's a women's rights activist. And so she's really, really worried about them. And she was having a really hard time getting anybody to respond to her. So, like, she filled out every form that she could find, but because they weren't involved with the military, and like some of the interpreters, she kind of just felt like nobody cared. And it sounds like they're still stuck because it was hard enough to get people like the interpreters out. So we got her in touch with the senator's office, and hopefully she's making some progress there, but it's kind of up in the air for those people.
Right. And Heath, just to kind of tie this back together, I mean, as you said, you've been trying to spotlight this issue. Of course, very relieved that your own colleague and these other more than 100,000 people are now out of the country. But, you know, there are other people that are left. I mean, for someone like this that Kelsey wrote about, what are the obstacles facing them going forward if they do want to leave?
Right. And just to put that number in perspective, not to get too deep into sure. criticism of the administration, but that 100,000+ number, only a fraction of that were actually at-risk Afghans. So many more were left behind, and the government itself has admitted that the majority of special immigrant visa applicants were left behind. So what it looks like on the ground there, it doesn't look good, to be honest. There's not a lot of good options. The Kabul airport has basically been a no-go. There's another airport in the north that's had very, very limited emergency flights. But for some sort of complicated reasons, it's not really much of an option either. So, a lot of desperate people are going overland to land crossings in either Pakistan or Uzbekistan. Tajikistan also has a border crossing, but those are really dangerous options. You have to go through some rural areas. They're all controlled by the Taliban. And the Taliban right now, they aren't super thrilled about people evacuating from the country. It doesn't make them look good if people are fleeing because they're scared. And, you know, on a practical level, they realize that they need some folks who know how to literally keep the lights on. So I'm hearing a lot of stories on the ground of people getting beaten up or turned, at the very least, turned away and not able to evacuate. So it's really tough going for the people left behind who do want to get out.
Well, we'll be monitoring this story, of course, from an Idaho lens as we see some of these folks potentially be resettled in Idaho. And thanks so much to Heath Druzin. He's a Boise-based freelance reporter and is very familiar with our audience here at Boise State Public Radio. Thanks, Heath, for coming on the show.
Always good to talk to you, Frankie.
Kevin, would like to start with you and specifically coverage of Governor Brad Little's announcement on Tuesday regarding the National Guard. What's going on?
Well, it was a pretty sobering announcement from the governor on Tuesday. He's calling out the National Guard again to try to get some help to overburdened hospitals. Hospitals are seeing record numbers of COVID-19 patients, more patients than we've seen, even during that big surge of cases, those record cases we saw back in the fall. We're seeing more folks in the hospital. We're seeing more folks in the ICU than ever. And that's leading to some huge overcrowding issues in the hospitals. And it's leading to the possibility, maybe even the probability, that hospitals are going to have to ration care in the weeks to come and go to this crisis standards of care that we've been hearing so much about.
And the governor, you know, characterized this as kind of a last ditch effort, really, to avoid that, as you said. So what do we know? What will the National Guard likely be doing to help alleviate the hospitals and clinics around the state?
Well, it looks like they're going to provide help. They're going to provide some extra sets of hands to hospitals. And that's really significant. You know, when Dave Jepson, the director of health and welfare, was on the weekly briefing with reporters a couple hours later, a couple hours after the governor's announcement, he said, you know, it's really not as much a problem of bed space in the hospitals. I mean, that's an issue. That's not a good situation right now at all. But he said the biggest problem right now is staffing. So that's where you're seeing the push to get the National Guard in, to try to get some federal workers in through a contract with the U.S. General Services Administration. It's just about trying to get some help to hospital workers who have been, you know, walking through fire for a year and a half and are now probably facing the most severe outbreak we've seen so far.
Yeah, and on our regular Wednesday Doctor Roundtable, we definitely hear from folks on the front lines talking about how challenging this is and that this really is. I mean, the burnout concerns are very real, mental health concerns among healthcare workers and what they're having to do. And the folks who've quit at different points throughout the pandemic or made decisions to move on. And now this really dire situation where they're confronting staffing issues at the same time. You know, hospitals are postponing elective surgeries. We've heard about primary health that has overflowing urgent care patients. And we're hearing from officials that it's just going to get worse, that the peak is not yet here. Rachel, I'd like to turn to you about a story you did actually. You know, we're talking about elected officials and what they are and are not saying about vaccines and masking. You did a story asking Treasure Valley elected officials about their vaccine status. What did you learn?
Yeah, so this story actually kind of took us a while because we asked a lot. We asked Boise elected officials, as well as like a lot of cities in Canyon County, and you know, people didn't respond, and we wanted to make sure they had received it. So it was a long time coming, but basically what we did is we sent kind of a basic questionnaire. Are you vaccinated? You know, how did you get your information about the vaccine? How would you recommend to constituents, how should they do their part to control the virus? So we reached out to almost, I think it was 69 county and city officials, and only 25 responded. So we got a lot of, we didn't get, you know, a ton of responses. Only one elected official admitted that he was unvaccinated, Darrell Bruner from the Napa City Council. He said he already got the virus and was confident he had natural immunity to it. So I would recommend, you know, people kind of look through, because we have responses from everyone on the Statesman's article. But yeah, it was kind of like, I don't know, I was kind of prepared not to get a lot of responses, just because, I mean, as I feel like everyone on this panel can speak to, elected officials have not been as forthcoming about a lot of vaccine stuff and things like that. But it was surprising to see so few people respond, even people that I talk to a lot and I kind of suspected that they would respond to me just because I have a good relationship with them, didn't respond. So it was just pretty eye-opening. So I recommend people look at that for more info.
Yeah, I want to point out just a couple ones that I noticed as far as, you know, how they went about talking about their decision making. I think it was Caldwell Mayor Garrett Nankolas talking about, you know, he spoke with his own medical providers and then that made him feel comfortable and like this was the right decision. I think maybe the Meridian mayor also said something similar. So that's really an interesting piece of this is, you know, some folks are offering that as a reason, you know, and what, and not saying go ahead and do that yourself necessarily, constituents, but, you know, indicating that that was something that turned their or made them make that decision for themselves.
Yeah, definitely. And that's what we saw in a lot of the responses were people saying, yeah, I was vaccinated. You know, I talked to my doctor, I looked on the CDC website, I read news. And then when asked, when we asked that question about, you know, what would you recommend to constituents, very few people said, I want them to get the vaccine. It was more like, you know, I think it would help, but I believe in personal choice. So I don't know. That was really interesting to me too, just like the line they towed and pretty consistently across the board. Everyone who responded had that line.
Yeah, and it's interesting to have that on the record. Kevin, of course, yeah, the numbers are not very good when it comes to COVID. Obviously, that's what we've been talking about. But talk a little bit specifically about children and, you know, elementary age kids and kids who can't get vaccinated. As a reminder, 12 and up are able to get vaccinated at this stage.
Again, this is an example where the numbers aren't very good at all. You know, we've heard so much said about how right now this is a pandemic of the unvaccinated. And unfortunately, that includes kids. As you mentioned, children under the age of 12 can't get the vaccine. And, you know, high school age children and you know, middle school age children are vaccinated at the lowest rates we've got in the state. I mean, they're at 20 to 30%. So not surprisingly, when you have that and you have the return of school, the childhood cases are surging. And that's something I'm tracking very closely. I'll have a little bit more coverage of that the first part of next week. But the numbers are pretty eye-opening.
And we're already seeing some schools move to online learning, right, at this early on in the school year.
Right. I mean, we saw Payette yesterday. We saw Compass Charter School in Meridian earlier this week. And right now it's kind of back to what we saw in the fall, where some schools are either shutting down short term or they're going to some sort of an online based learning. You know, it's a continuation of what we saw last fall with schools, you know, in some cases opening or closing or going to some sort of a staggered schedule in response to case numbers. And, you know, as you said, and as we were talking about, the numbers are not trending in the right direction. So what we're seeing right now in the spiraling of cases, you know, you would think that as school is just now reopening, as kids are just now coming back into the classrooms, in many cases in schools that are not requiring face masks or have what amounts to an optional face mask policy in West Data, you would think that those case numbers are only going to increase in the weeks to come. It's an unsettling situation for parents, for teachers, for administrators, for trustees.
And I guess that my question would be, well, first, I'd love you to talk a little bit more specifically about the different masking policies that we're seeing. You mentioned West Ada, but any other schools that are doing something, either choosing to mandate or you know, absolutely saying no or doing the opt-out option. But what is the line? Are there... Are officials saying if we reach, you know, see this happen, then we'll consider these mask mandates? Or is it really there's just resistance among those districts, thinking of West Ada in particular and others? Is there kind of a line that they're saying once it reaches this point, we'll consider this?
Well, Idaho is a local control state. And if you like local control, you've got it here. You've got 115 right. school districts trying to figure out the same problem, but trying to come up with their own solutions to the problem. On my podcast this week, I talked to Dr. David Pate, and we talked about how the schools have responded. It's what we saw last year, only with more cases and maybe more implications for school-age kids. We're seeing policies that are all over the map. West Ada with the optional policy, where you have about a third of the students are not masking at all. Boise started the school year with a mask requirement. Caldwell earlier this week decided to reinstitute a mask mandate that will run until, I believe, the middle of October. It is all over the place, and it's likely to continue to change and evolve as the situation changes and evolves.
And there's also your colleague, Devin Bodkin, wrote about something in Eastern Idaho. Tell us about what's going on in the Teton School District.
Right. You have a little bit of a jurisdictional struggle in the Teton District in Eastern Idaho, right near the Wyoming border. The city of Victor, a small community in Teton Valley. I love it. My father-in-law lives there. I get there as often as I can, and not nearly often enough. It's gorgeous.
Beautiful. Yeah.
It's heaven in Eastern Idaho. It's a wonderful place. But the city fathers there, the city council, put a mask mandate in place. Well, the Teton School District is not going to comply with that within the city of Victor, where they have an elementary school. Most of the other schools in the Teton District are in Driggs and Tetonia. So you've got the one elementary school in Victor, and they are not going to go along with the mask mandate in that school. So, local control. If you like local control, this is your moment.
Right. And showdowns even within local control, local exactly. jurisdictions, even, at the micro level. Kelsey, I'd like to bring you into this a little bit because you wrote about testing and funding for testing, COVID-19 testing, that is, that's now available to Idaho schools. Is it being used?
It only got stood up like a couple days ago.
Okay.
So it was about 3 weeks after the governor's announcement that they were able to put this program in place. He directed $30 million in COVID relief funding to be used for school districts who wanted to test. It's kind of an opt-in program again. And so when I initially asked, there was nothing to report on from there. But there are some districts who have been using the Vault medical swab, nasal swab tests. And three school districts so far have indicated interest in the funding, and they're starting the process with the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare to get that set up. And basically what they do is indicate that they're interested in setting something up. They have to tell the Department of Health and Welfare what their parameters are, who they're targeting, and that I think the funding gets approved from there. But no funding has been distributed yet because they're just starting the process. And I asked Moscow School District if they were going to opt in, and they said that they ordered some of those nasal swab tests as well instead.
Okay, so brand new program. We'll see how that works in the fall semester as it continues. Kelsey, okay, here's the number, $479 million. That's the number that is being given by a couple of groups that did a study around the loss for Idaho's economy when it comes to a lack of childcare. So tell us about this particular study, but then also what these two groups are hoping to do with this information.
So this was something that sort of flew under the radar last year in early 2020, because obviously COVID happened the month after the report got released. But The U.S. Chamber of Commerce released a report about the economic effects of breakdowns in the access to childcare in four states, and Idaho was one of those that they studied. And they looked at how absences and employee turnover related to difficulties in accessing childcare added up to an economic loss. And they came up with that $479 million number. And the Idaho Association for the Education of Young Children director, Beth Oppenheimer, and the Idaho Association of Commerce and Industries president, Alex LeBeau, that's a lot to say, both came together and kind of looked at that report, looked at the numbers. They did a survey of the state and decided to come together as two kind of unlikely allies to tackle this issue. And they basically said they wanted to come together because they are tired of waiting for the state to make any significant headway on this issue. And it's something that affects businesses. It's something that affects children and families. So they just decided to start doing it themselves. And especially now, it seems pretty salient because there are so many places around Boise and even across Idaho that are struggling with getting people back in their staffing positions and just really struggling with that. And I have a feeling, and Alex LeBeau backed me up on this, that a lot of it is related to people not being able to get childcare, because one of the issues behind that is childcare places can't afford to hire the people that would stay around. And particularly as wages are increasing to gather more people for places like fast food restaurants and retail, it's very difficult to attract someone to a childcare job 8 hours a day, if not more, for, you know, $10 an hour or $9 an hour, which is still what a lot of them are having to pay. Right. And so what they're trying to do is get together public and private partnerships to help connect businesses and childcare centers to lower the cost of quality childcare for their employees. And so that could be a collaborative of places like Head Start, places like the school districts, or, you know, a place like Schweitzer Engineering up in Moscow or down here in Boise, to offer it as a benefit to their employees to reserve a spot at a childcare center that has high quality childcare, or to, you know, subsidize some of their tuition. And so they're really trying to promote that with businesses around here because they see it as an infrastructure type of benefit, the same as healthcare, the same as you know, other employee perks. And so they're still kind of in the early days of it. And Caldwell School District and Kendrick School District have implemented something similar, but we'll see where it goes.
And so would the aim be in part in some way, because of course, right, if they're having issues with hiring people or keep retaining folks when they could make $17 an hour to work at a fast food restaurant instead of $10 an hour at a daycare center, would the collaboratives help to keep those costs down so they're not transferred on to the families as well?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a thorny issue because the businesses can't really help with wages so much as just getting those spots then and helping with the tuition costs. But I think the state could still step in and help some with those wage enhancements to keep people on staff. But yeah, if there were to be business support for tuition, that would definitely help to keep costs down for people who aren't necessarily in low income brackets, but who could still use the help with childcare, because it's for my daughter who's one, it's $570 a month for twice a week.
Wow.
And so it's definitely not a small amount of money. And even if you make a good amount of money per year, it's still a really high cost.
Yeah, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe this, like many other things, was an issue that was already going on before the pandemic, that it was hard to find placement in daycares, and there was already a lot of competition, and it's just gotten much worse. So you mentioned they're trying this kind of bottom-up approach because they're tired of trying to wait for the legislature, but is there any interest in the legislature to address this? I mean, is there any movement? And Kevin, if you have any thoughts on that too, but Kelsey, what are you hearing or reporting on with that?
Well, the thing that Alex LeBeau said was, I don't count on the state for anything right now with the way that they're operating. And so that kind of tells you where he's at with the legislature and what he expects out of them, and kind of also where businesses are at, because he represents many large businesses across the state. And so it's, they're kind of at the point where they're not expecting anything out of the legislature, especially this coming session. And on the contrary, education has been sort of a target for a lot of people in the legislature. So mm-hmm. it seems like they're looking to skirt around them.
Yeah. Well, Kevin, want to pivot to the education task force that Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan is headed up along with Representative Priscilla Giddings. They were co-chairs of this task force, and it has wrapped up, right? Tell us what mm-hmm. kind of the conclusion of it was and what their recommendations look like.
Well, the task force had its last meeting a week ago, Thursday, and they came out with really a broad list of recommendations. And I think the task force members are saying these are kind of sketchy at this point. They need to be fleshed out a little bit more. Kind of a generic recommendation on school choice, some more technical corrections in the law, especially in that House Bill 377, that anti-indoctrination, anti-critical race theory law that was passed earlier this year. What I think was kind of telling in those recommendations, and this one kind of almost seems like a no-brainer, but one of the six recommendations was, as a task force, we want to work with the House and Senate Education Committees on fleshing out this legislation. Well, what's interesting about that is this task force really needs the legislature at this point if they're going to get any of this done, because they don't have any other allies to speak of. Obviously, the governor's office isn't going to embrace anything that comes out of this group because of the election and the primary that's coming up. Most education groups, the school boards, the school administrators, Idaho Business for Education, the teachers union have pretty much dismissed this task force. They haven't wanted to participate and have really questioned the motives of the task force, the makeup of the task force. So if they're going to get anything done, they really need legislative support and they need legislative allies. There's only the one legislator on the group, and that's Priscilla Giddings. It was interesting. I did a piece about this on Thursday, just kind of what happens from here. And I spoke to Stephen Thame. He's the chairman of the Senate Education Committee, pretty conservative Republican, testified in front of the task force last week. And I asked him, well, what did you make of the recommendations? And he said, well, I read them and I really can't tell exactly what they want and what exactly they, you know, where exactly they're trying to go here. And, you know, Senator Thane is usually pretty, pretty candid about things, but he's pretty noncommittal about what the task force is talking about and what they're recommending, because, you know, again, we haven't seen any legislation. We haven't seen any detail. They spent an hour talking about this stuff at the end of, you know, 16 hours of meetings. So, you know, we'll see how it gets fleshed out, if it gets fleshed out, if this task force is going to come back with any concrete recommendations. And if legislators, even fellow conservatives in the legislature, if they take up any of these ideas.
Right. Well, I guess kind of zooming out, just to remember that this task force, I mean, it is very unusual. As you mentioned, there was only one lawmaker on it in the first place. And so as far as what this will mean for policy, as you're talking about, that there hasn't been a lot of lawmakers who are raising their hands saying, you know what, that sounds great. I'm ready to write up a bill with you. This is unusual. It's not an interim committee that's coming up with a bill or a proposal. This is pretty different or just as far as the normal process of legislation and how things get made in the Idaho legislature. Is that fair to say?
It's definitely fair to say, and it really is different. I mean, you talked about the interim committees. What's different with an interim committee, Frankie, is that it's made up by legislators. It's formed by the legislature. They decide right at the end of each session which interim committees they want to put together. Now, that's no guarantee of anything actually happening. You know, I talked to Wendy Horman, Republican from Idaho Falls, for this story. She spent three summers on an interim committee looking at the school funding formula, which is a really complicated Byzantine formula. Here we are after three summers of that and a couple more years, and the school funding formula has basically been unchanged. So she kind of laughed a little bit when I asked her about the task force versus interim committees. And she said, you know, look, interim committees don't always you know, there's no guarantee that interim communities are going to get legislation through, and there isn't. But this is such a, it's such an odd construct, not like anything we've seen recently. So I really can't tell what's going to happen with the legislature, and really it's going to probably come down to what individual legislators think of what this task force is talking about and whether they decide that it's an issue they're interested in, an issue they're passionate about, and an issue that they think resonates with their voters in an election year.
Right. And I guess, you know, Lieutenant Governor McGeehan, she's really, you know, indicated this is something that constituents want to talk about. She wants to hear from them. And speaking of, can you give us an update? The Idaho Press Club has been trying to get public comments that were submitted to the task force. They sued for that when Lieutenant Governor McGeehan did not give those under the public records law. Where are we with that now? I know that the Supreme Court, the Idaho Supreme Court, weighed in last week.
Well, the Supreme, well, the a district judge weighed
Excuse
in.
Excuse me. Yes,
said,
thank you. Thank
right,
you.
And said a pretty scathing ruling, saying that Lieutenant Governor McGeehan has gone to extraordinary lengths and used some rather unusual justifications for getting around the, you know, public records law. You know, I think we're kind of in wait and see mode. I mean, this is a couple of days ago, and Kelsey, you may know better because you work with Audrey. Audrey tweeted out earlier this week that she's still waiting on the documents, and I think that's kind of where we are still, kind of in a holding pattern.
As far as I know, that's still true.
So, you know, we're looking forward to seeing them.
Yeah, and that was kind
of... says we're entitled to see them, so we're looking forward to it.
Right, right. Rachel, tell us what's going on with water and drought news, specifically in the Boise area, and some potential shutoffs coming?
Yeah, so if you live in a subdivision that is on irrigated water, if you're part of an irrigation district, most likely your irrigated water will shut off on September 15th. So that's in a couple weeks, and that is almost a month before people are used to seeing their irrigated water shut off. And, you know, this early shut off obviously impacts people who use irrigation for their lawns and gardens and stuff. But I think the larger impact is going to be on farmers and, you know, especially in Canyon County. I've talked to a few farmers that, you know, are worried about the early shutoffs and what that is going to mean for our local food system. And I think that, you know, for our summer vegetables that we love, I think they're going to be okay. But the farmers I talked to said that they were worried about the fall crop that they start around this time, probably a few weeks ago, a lot of them were started. And, you know, they're used to having water until, you know, beginning of October when it starts to get cooler. And, you know, they're not going to have that water anymore. So, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how they deal with that. And, you know, a lot of them are saying maybe this water, you know, crisis of sorts is kind of the new normal, and that might change the type of crops that Idaho farmers plant. And, you know, a lot of decisions might have to go into how to, you know, maintain sustainable agriculture with, you know, drought conditions.
Right. And as climate change continues to wreak havoc on Idaho, and will likely get worse. This is a really interesting piece of that, to say the least. Your article, for folks, we will link it on our website. It does go into some interesting tidbits about how to save your lawn for folks who have a lawn and want to do their best to save it when it's going to be so dry. But guess what? There are also some options, including pollinator gardens, which we've been covering a lot here on Idaho Matters. Our Samantha Wright has done a whole series on pollinator gardens and how to convert your lawn to that. So if you want to look into that, it might be a good time to do so. You can find more on our website. And Kevin, I want to shift back to you about one more thing about the state and education budget requests, specifically the education budget. And that Superintendent Sherry Ibarra is requesting money for all-day kindergarten?
Yes, she is. And this is kind of the first step in the budget process that will unfold between now and late winter, early spring when the legislature gets back to town. The superintendent's budget request includes funding for all-day kindergarten. And what's significant about that is that it's another step in sort of this momentum towards state-funded full-day kindergarten. If you remember, the State Board of Education just a couple of weeks ago voted to recommend all-day kindergarten. And we saw legislation at the very end of the 2020 session. It didn't get out of committee, but you saw it coming from a couple of Republicans. Why is the legislature talking about this? Why is the State Board talking about it? And now why is State Superintendent Cherry Ibarra talking about it? Well, we've crunched the numbers. Almost every kid in the state can get access to all-day kindergarten. It's not really an access issue, but it is a funding issue because the state right now is only funding a half a day of kindergarten. So school districts have to figure out how to pay for the rest of it. And they're using a variety of different methods to do it. One of the big ways that districts pay for all-day kindergarten is they go to voters and they ask voters to approve 1 or 2 year property tax levies to pay for all-day kindergarten.
Right.
So the reason the state is looking at it and why you've got Republicans in the State House talking about it is they want to get that off of the property tax. And they want to put it onto state taxes so it's a little bit more of a stable funding source. School districts don't have to go back to patrons every year or two, hat in hand, asking for more money to continue kindergarten. And when you're sitting on a $1.4 billion surplus, which is what Idaho is doing, unprecedented surplus, it's not a question of money. The money is there if the state wants to put it into all-day kindergarten, if the legislature wants to fund it. There's certainly plenty of money to do it.
Right. Worth repeating that number again, $1.4 billion surplus?
Billion with a B, yes.
Yep.
I feel like Dr. Evil here. But
yeah, exactly. Rachel, I actually want to, end on another story of yours. Going into the Labor Day weekend, maybe some folks are thinking about what recreation activities they're going to do. Tell us a little bit about this kind of controversy, I guess, going on with ATVs at a Foothills site and what's going on in Eagle.
Yes, so it likely won't be ready by this weekend for people to use, but there's been talk for a while about this area that the city of Eagle annexed in the foothills, and it's actually BLM land, so it's kind of like a weird control thing. But a lot of subdivisions back up to that space. And, you know, as people probably know, BLM land, you can pretty much do anything, including target shooting. So a lot of people who, equestrians, hikers, bikers go out there and were complaining for a while about the target shooting happening at the same time that they were, riding their horses. So the city council kind of made this plan. It was actually a separate group kind of came up with this plan to include ATV trails, separate hiking trails, biking trails, and then also a gun range, like a designated gun range on the land, just to kind of satisfy all of these user groups. But the neighbors in that area are, complain about having ATV trails right near their houses. And, they say it doesn't solve the problem of the shooting range, because there's still going to be guns going off in that land.
And Rachel, I'm going to be sure to link to your article so people can read more about it. I'm going to have to wrap you up there. Many thanks to our reporter roundtable today, Kevin Richard, Kelsey Mosley Morris, and Rachel Spacek. Thanks so much. Have a safe and fun Labor Day weekend, everyone. I'm Frankie Barnhill with Idaho Matters.